Hi. Thank you all very much for coming. Can I ask everyone to switch their phones off, please? My name is David Birkin. I'm the artist who's got the show on here at the moment, and I'm very pleased to introduce our four panelists today. I'm just going to read out a brief biography for all of them, and then I think the format is going to be quite an informal conversation. I'll throw a few questions out, and they're all coming from quite distinct perspectives, and then we'll throw it open to the floor for any questions. So, David Roden, on my left, is a leading authority on the ethics of war and conflict. He's a senior fellow at the Carnegie Council for Ethics in International Affairs in New York, and senior research fellow at the University of Oxford. His publications include War and Self-Defense, 2002, which was awarded the American Philosophical Association Sharp Prize, articles in leading philosophy and law journals, and a number of edited books. And on my right, Elspeth Van Beeren is a lecturer in political science and a member of the Global Insecurity Centre at the University of Bristol. Specialising in American security cultures, politics, and foreign policy, she previously held research positions at the University of Sussex, the University of Copenhagen, and at York University in Canada. Having published extensively on Guantanamo and the War on Terror, including the forthcoming security collisions, her work continues to engage with questions surrounding the practices, technologies, and cultures that mobilise publics for and against war. Her latest project is a study of invisibility in security. On my far left is Chris Woods, who is a London-based investigative journalist whose book Sudden Justice, America's Secret Drone Wars, publishes in April. A former senior producer with the BBC's Newsnight and Panorama programmes, he's been covering the global war on terror since 2001. His investigations have taken him to Iraq, Syria, Afghanistan and Pakistan, as well as to Israel and Palestine, all nations where armed drones have come to dominate. Chris Woods set up and ran the Bureau of Investigative Journalism's award-winning drones team back in 2011. He is presently producing a major TV series on Al-Qaeda's operations in Saudi Arabia and runs a project monitoring the international air war in Iraq and Syria against Islamic State. And then, I'm afraid I have to read this on my phone. And then on my right, there's a reason. On my right is Julian Salabras, who teaches at the Courtauld Institute. On my right is Edmund Clark. Edmund Clark is an award-winning artist whose work links history, politics and representation. His work traces ideas of shared humanity, otherness, and unseen experience through landscape, architecture, and the documents, possessions, and environments of subjects of political tension. Recent works, Guantanamo, If the Light Goes Out, and Control Order House, engage with state censorship to explore the hidden experiences and spaces of control and incarceration in the global war on terror. And he also teaches at the London College of Communication.
I have an exhibition of the book out on the 26th of February. Go. Flowers, Kings, and all. Talk very well.
So, I have a whole bunch of questions, things that I'm interested in, things that kind of inspired some of the works that I've made for the show. This talk isn't about this exhibition, but I am going to kind of pull out a few of the, the facets that were the impetus for making some of those works. And those particular kind of those facets of the drone program, which I'm hoping that these guys can expand on. I think as an opening question, because we're not doing everybody's not giving an individual talk, I wonder if I can ask each of the panelists to respond to a very basic question, which is, what is it about drones that's so new? What is it about drones that scares us? What is it about drones that make them different from any other conventional weapon? Because essentially drones are, you know, they're a piece of technology. They're a weapon. And yet they somehow seem to have captured, in a kind of zeitgeisty way, a real kind of deep-down fear in people, for probably very good reasons. But I wanted to ask each of the panellists, what makes them different from conventional weapons? Do you want to start, Chris?
Yeah, I used to think, I've been looking obsessively at drones for, this is the fifth year I've been focused exclusively on the question of drones, and for quite a while I used to think they were just another weapon system. But But I've changed my opinion in recent years, and I think what's different and unique about them is lies in their origins. They're an assassin's weapon. They were kicking around for about 15 years before they were weaponized. But once they were weaponized, once the CIA put missiles on them in early 2001, explicitly to assassinate Osama bin Laden prior to 9/11, actually, that changed what the drone was, what it was capable of, and then that began to change the way we fought the war. So I think they have revolutionized warfare because they put the decision makers in the cockpit in real time, and we've never had that capacity of warfare before. It's the equivalent of having David Cameron whispering in the ear of the sniper on the battlefield, and that has changed. So for me, it has fairly profoundly changed war.
David?
Sure, thanks very much for the invitation, David. So I'm a moral philosopher who spends my time thinking about the ethics of warfare, and the basic fundamental question that you're dealing with in that pursuit is about when and how and for what reasons it can never be permissible to go out and intentionally kill another human being. It's a very, very difficult question to answer. Now, the old way of thinking about it, the old paradigm of war, we had a pretty clear account of what it was that made killing in war permissible. And it was essentially that there was this domain of warfare that was legally and culturally and normally geographically distinct from ordinary life. And within that domain of warfare, one was essentially entitled to kill any enemy wearing a uniform and within the chain of command. And what is very interesting to me about drones is that they are, as it were, the lightning rod for an incredible transformation that's taking place in the way that we think about the permissibility of killing in war and more generally. It's not the sole cause or even necessarily the dominant or primary cause, but it is the one facet of one war that really makes absolutely obvious the transition that's occurring. So if the old paradigm of war was that you had this domain of heart in which you were essentially entitled to kill a group of other people just because of their status, just because they were combatants rather than civilians, in this new paradigm, we have to look at who gets killed and who is immune from being killed on the basis of something about them, right? About their status as individuals. Because what drones allow us to do is to pick out a particular individual and say, that person there, we kill. And when we do that, we have to think about what those reasons are for killing and whether those are sufficient or not. And they can't just be the old status-based reasons that he belongs to that group of uniform-wearing people. So it's, as it were, the lightning rod of that whole transition in the way that we think about the morality, the legality, and the cultural aspects and signs around that as well that I find very, very interesting.
I think I'm going to agree with David, and I think it's something about the precision and the compression of time and space that is introduced by drones. But I want to be a bit contradictory and say that I think we ought to remember back to times like the introduction of the submarine or the introduction of the helicopter, and remember that perhaps as these technologies were introduced, there was similar kind of questions raised about what direction war was taken. And in particular, in conflicts like Vietnam, I think we're very, like, although you described our previous type of engagement with war as very bounded, wars like Vietnam, where the helicopter really came to dominate, did not reflect that type of pattern. And so just as we're a bit anxious about drones now, people might have been quite anxious about the introduction of other technologies in the past. So it is new, but I want to add a bit of a brackets around that new and sort of say maybe we need to have a less ahistorical approach to drones.
I suppose coming at this from the point of view as a visual artist, the thing which strikes me is the technology. I'm not convinced we actually are dealing with something that's completely new in terms of the impact of the technology, but it's the timing that this is taking place. And it's the timing in relation to what's happening with kind of the contemporary media discourse about war and about weaponry. And I'm kind of summing that in two ways. On the one hand, we have this this idea, we've had a war of images since 9/11, The war is carried out on our TV screens. Who has the most impact? Who makes the most effect? And that's what the ISIS videos are all about. And I think the way in which kind of drones are playing a part, which is perhaps new in relation to this kind of discourse, this media image war, is that it, on the one hand, makes the execution of people without any legal process much easier for us to stomach and to accept. So we have a report on the news which says a drone strike took out a key leader in a network that is clearly against us. And that happens without any kind of questioning at all. And that is an extra legal execution. But because of the way in which the media discourse has gone, that is just accepted without any real question. And secondly, it means that war can be carried out in these new kind of legal definition of battle spaces beyond the reach of our ability to visualise it and to record it. You know, I think one of the reasons that drone technology has taken off under Obama is because there were too many people coming back in body bags from Iraq, and the coverage of things like Guantanamo Bay and extraordinary was so counterproductive that actually they decided it's much easier just to kill people over there, and it happens over there, and there are no bodies coming back in bags, and we don't see where it's happening. We don't see that battlefield. We don't see where that's taking place. Therefore, it doesn't really register on the kind of the TV screen in the media discourse. And as a visual artist, I think that's kind of a real challenge. I think how do we, whether you're a photographer, whether you're a filmmaker, how do we deal with trying to continue to question warfare, the battlefield, when it's taking place over there, when it's so hard to reach, when it is so hard to visualise? That, I think, is kind of the real impact in terms of the newness of drones, which I find quite interesting and quite worrying.
So, I mean, there's also two separate things, which is the extent to which body bags of American soldiers are visible and the extent, on the other hand, to which civilian casualties are visible. But there have been shifts that have taken place between the end of Vietnam and the first Gulf War, and now on both those on both sides. So you can kind of broadly, I mean, correct me if you want to, but broadly, you know, Vietnam was a free-for-all. You had photographers going out and photograph, being given access to photograph whatever they wanted. Very rapidly after that, you have a realization by the U.S. military that this backfired spectacularly for public opinion. And so by the time you have the first Gulf War, you've already got like the process of embedding, whereby the only story that we get from the battlefield is through journalists who are riding with the military. And then you also have the first prohibition on the flag-draped coffins coming back on newspaper outlets actually being allowed to publish those photographs. So going back to what you're saying, and also I know that you're interested in the whole issue of visibility, Elspeth. With one of the things that drone warfare signals really is a lack of visibility on the part of the casualties, but also on the part of, because there are no, sorry, casualties on the American side, but also on the civilian side. And one of the clearest examples of that has been the redefinition of the term insurgent to be any male fighting age within the vicinity of a drone strike, which has been hugely contentious. So I wondered if you would kind of, what are your thoughts on kind of the visibility, the shift in visibility on both the civilian casualty side and the in terms of the way that we digest war since the first Gulf War?
Well, I think on the civilian casualty side, there is on the one hand the imprecision and the doubt which is cast about the statistics coming out, and Chris will know about that here at the Institute of Journalism. On the kind of the visualisation of those casualties, it's, you know, where these places are, it's dangerous to go to. You know, not many people go there. But for me, what it highlights is the importance of what imagery comes out of those places by the people that aren't there. And I think that's something which I'm interested in, because it it's a way of trying to get a bit past this idea of otherness. And one of the things which drones are doing is it's really reinforcing this idea of otherness. There is no shared kind of battlefield. These people are over there. We don't know anything about them. And, you know, what's happening with ISIS is escalating this. It's becoming more and more problematic. But, you know, there are people in places like Waziristan who are trying to record what's going on, who are trying to take photographs, trying to film what's happening, and trying to get that imagery out. And that kind of imagery is really important.
But that, I would say, I mean, that imagery, it's not difficult to find that imagery, whether it's in Waziristan or today, somebody was sending me pictures of, you know, charming email box, dead kids from Iraq. The imagery's there. What's missing is our willingness to engage and see it. And our media won't publish that imagery. And so the absence of imagery is not necessarily there. In fact, the war in Syria, the war in Iraq, very well recorded. Go onto social media, look on Facebook, look on YouTube, look on Twitter. It's full of dead civilians. We don't see that. And I think that the primary dislocation is our unwillingness to deal with the implication of our military actions. For those who saw Tonya's film last week and Shazad Akbar printing off the pictures of the dead kids, putting them on rooftops of buildings, I spoke to a drone pilot about that once and said, you know, what would that have meant to you? He said, oh, they just told us to turn to infrared, because on infrared you can't see wounds. And it's about. I don't think that there are difficult places to access. They're not impossible. The imagery is available, but we seem to have made a collective decision that we don't want to see this stuff. We don't want to have a responsibility.
The only interesting thing when we're killing our own. I mean, the only kind of real coverage that hits the headlines in the West, and certainly in Britain, is when we're being told, well, a Briton who was in Waziristan or a Briton who was in Yemen has been killed by a drone. Then we seem to be interested. Otherwise, it's just...
I think, if I may, part of the challenge really is if you see destruction, sometimes it's very hard to connect that to the cause of that destruction. Including the policy that enabled it, but also the technology that might have delivered it. And so these pictures are not perhaps telling a story in the same way that in my research on Guantanamo, the Guantanamo figure told a story in just the object, the body itself. Whereas these photos that you're talking about are perhaps less communicative in that kind of way of putting a blame on a particular type of policy.
We could sit here and check now, pretty much guarantee that you will find no record in any BBC report in the last 6 months of a civilian killed in an Allied airstrike in Iraq. It's an excising from the entire public domain, not just visually, but in all forms. It's a bigger problem.
But I mean, at the same time, I mean, you made the point elsewhere, so you do need to keep a historical perspective on these things, and militaries throughout history have attempted to control information, that's absolutely clear. And the question is, are we in a freer and better place now than we were in the past? I think there's no question that we are. So, I mean, I spent time with military personnel, I know that you do as well, and I know that they are acutely aware of the fact that they are under potential constant observation. They're acutely aware of the fact that there are somewhere in the region of, I think, between 4 and 5 billion camera-enabled phones in the world, so that anything that happens there, essentially, you're constantly under this potential gaze and potential scrutiny. They are intensely aware of that. And I think that one of the huge motivations pushing towards remote systems, more automated systems, is a concern, obviously, the casualties on our side, but also a concern for the risk of civilian casualties during the course of operations as being a real operational constraint on the military's ability to act. Now, does that mean that they get those decisions right? Does it mean that they're not killing people who would be killed? No, it doesn't. But it does mean that those pressures are there and they are acutely felt, I think, by the military.
I want to go back to this issue of the targeting being one of the precision being one of the things that, on the one hand, from an ethical point of view, you know, the military trumpets it and the politicians trumpet it as being one of the advantages of drone warfare. But I feel like the precision targeting nature of it is also what makes so many people uncomfortable from an ethical standpoint. So if you think hypothetically, you know, there have been, throughout history, there have been, to take an example, American citizens killed by the American military who've either gotten in the way or who've been fighting on the wrong side. But then when you have an issue, when you have a case like the one that we saw, the very high-profile case of Anwar al-Awlaki and his 16-year-old son and 17-year-old cousin, all three of them American citizens, all of them targeted by the US military, the fact that that was an intentional targeting of American citizens by their own government in a country which wasn't technically a war zone, with which we have not declared war, I feel like that makes people a lot more uncomfortable than if American citizens had been killed simply on the battlefield because they've been firing in the wrong direction. Would you agree with that?
I think it's certainly the perception. I don't think that's correct at all. I mean, so one of the, I mean, if I can just take a step back for a moment, if you'll forgive me, one of the big transitions that's occurred within the field of academic philosophy, the ethics of war, has been an understanding that if it's ever going to be morally, and hence also legally appropriate, ever to kill a person, it has to be because of some relevant factors about that person. And it essentially comes down to a couple of very, very basic conditions. It can be morally permissible to kill another human being if that human being is posing an imminent unjust threat to someone else. That's it, basically. This whole kind of mechanism that we had around the state of war, that said if you're in a state of war, you could inflict harm in a very expansive way, where you could have collateral harm that was considered to be appropriate, numbering hundreds or thousands of civilians as a result of trying to strike a military target. None of that really makes sense if we start from some pretty simple and hard-to-deny assumptions about the rights and status of human beings. We believe that human beings have rights. You can intentionally kill them essentially only if they are responsible for imposing an unjust imminent harm on someone else. In other words, you're killing them as a matter either of self-defense or of the defense of someone else. That's it, basically. So when you talk about something like a drone strike and the targeted nature of that, that's, I think, the question you have to be asking. Are you using necessary and proportionate force in order to stop somebody from committing an imminent, unjust attack or harm on someone else? If you're not doing that, then it's
an obligation under the laws of war. In fact, you could very strongly argue that almost all American covert drone strikes off the hot battlefield have not involved imminent attack.
That's correct.
John Brennan, the present head of the CIA, has been pushing for an expanded definition. He wants a definition of imminence which means not quite so imminent. Absolutely. But in terms of precision as well, I think precision is Graham Lamb, former head of the British Army, speaking a couple of years ago, made a very good point. He said, if you get it wrong, precision actually works against you, because precision is going to put that bomb right where it shouldn't be and kill the wrong people. I think also one of the challenges we have with drones is we're dealing with the first iteration of armed drones, which are slow-moving, they are relatively precise, they're operating in uncontested post-conflict environments, not contested by air forces or anti-aircraft. The next iteration of armed drones might be very fast, because they're going to have to fight off other drones, they're going to have to fight off anti-aircraft, and because they're moving much faster, they're going to be less precise, and they're also probably going to be carrying bigger bombs, because in order to achieve the effect and get through, that's why we use F-15s with bigger bombs, because they're going very, very fast and they're less precise, so you use a bigger weapon to saturate the area. So we might actually be in a very narrow window of precision at the moment with armed drones, and our next engagement with the drones could be much more problematic, and then we're really going to have trouble, because we're going to be talking about a very different kind of weapon system with a very different kind of casualty print.
And we won't have a monopoly.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, that's a really important question. I mean, to what extent is the United States setting the agenda for what future governments, principally the Chinese and the Russians, what will be considered allowable? And then obviously the second question is, when you talk about the later iterations of drone technology, when they become fully autonomous and the decision to strike will not be taken by an Air Force man down at Creech Air Force Base in Nevada, but it will be taken by the onboard algorithms within the drone. So it will be. So that then raises the question of where is culpability in terms of war crimes or in terms of, you know, any other kind of international statutes.
But the idea of kind of the accuracy of the technology, I think isn't that all kind of caught up with this whole representation of the technology? Because as I understand, there are kind of basically two types of use of drones. It's covert signature strikes, which are kind of based on patterns of behaviour, and are about disrupting networks. It's kind of acknowledged that they may not even be taking out really important people, but they might just take out a messenger who's taking a particular message, or people who deliver stuff, and it's just kind of disrupting a network. So that is kind of based on intelligence, as is the targeting process. You have kind of the whole bureaucracy administration, which is about validating what's going to be a target, who is a target, but that's all still based on the accuracy of the intelligence, which is feeding into that decision-making process. And then, we look at the intelligence which has come out of Afghanistan, which has come out of Iraq, in Afghanistan in relation to people who ended up being part of extraordinary rendition, or people who ended up in Guantanamo Bay. The intelligence is incredibly poor. Because on the ground, people don't know what's going on. One group is saying that's the Taliban, that's the baddie, then 6 weeks later, in the exchange of dollars, someone else is saying that's the baddie, that's the baddie. That intelligence is really weak and really poor. And if that's the intelligence on which these incredibly accurate weapons are supposed to be being targeted, then that's problematic, because it's kind of fallacious.
There was a drone strike in Yemen last week, which is really worth looking at. So America hadn't bombed in Yemen for quite a while, but as you might know, Yemen is an absolute crisis at the moment, rather than the usual relative crisis. So there's been the Houthi uprising, the Houthis have taken control of the Sana'a, the president and prime minister have resigned, half the cabinet is under half the rest, the Houthis are fighting with Al-Qaeda in the south. It's a very, very volatile situation. The Americans closed their embassy to the public last week. Reuters ran a story on a Saturday citing senior US intelligence officials saying that the US had suspended drone strikes in Yemen because of the chaos. And then there was kickback from both the Pentagon and the White House saying, no, it's not the case. And almost to prove that they were still capable of doing this, the Americans then carried out a drone strike. Fine, they killed three Al-Qaeda. Except they didn't. They killed two Al-Qaeda and a 12-year-old boy. And suddenly the story becomes the schoolboy the Americans had killed. And the two Al-Qaeda guys they killed were low-ranking. They did not feature. It was simply the United States showing that it could still engage. But in my mind, what they were doing was the equivalent of throwing a hand grenade into a marketplace and saying, look, we're still in the game. To step that back slightly, 6 months earlier, Barack Obama announcing air power in the campaign for Iraq and Syria said, we're modelling this on Yemen, because it's a success story. The same Yemen that today is in absolute chaos. He got picked up on that when he was in India last week, and Obama said, he actually used the same word, the model. He said, well, it's the model we're stuck with. And you kind of think, well, somewhere along the line, someone should be making the rational decisions here. And it is my, this is where drones kind of slip into a sort of broader concern for me about the threshold of war, the likelihood of war. We throw these things in, we tell ourselves that they don't kill civilians, they do. We tell ourselves they make things better. Where's the empirical evidence that it does? The State Department's own evidence says before we started using bombs in Yemen, Al-Qaeda was 200 today. It's probably 5,000. Now, that's not cause and effect, but they're probably connected. And we are in a very volatile period of history right now. The whole of the Middle East seems to be, on the edge. And our response is only military. Where's diplomacy? Where are the words United Nations in any conversation involving Western diplomats these days? So drones are part of a systemic problem, in my view. And this lowering of a threshold, this view that just put some drones in it, that will help, without actually understanding whether it can or will.
Well, that's the flip side, isn't it, of precision, is the ease and the willingness with which politicians in the future will seek out military solutions to diplomatic or political problems. And this issue of the indefinite expansion of the battlefield, both geographically and temporally. So we no longer have any... it's not like we really had one before. You know, there's the fact that the United States hasn't declared war since 1942 and has only, you know, sanctioned six of those of its 20-plus conflicts through Congress and, you know, even sanctioned by Congress. We already didn't have a very kind of old-fashioned conception of a war zone or warring parties. But it's now got to the point with drone technology where pretty much anyone of any nationality in any part of the world at any time is a viable target if, as you say, they can, you know, if there are enough grounds.
Yeah,
there's evidence. It's not to do with the uniform that you're wearing. It's to do with, you know, the intelligence against you.
If I could only just again to be the bearer of bad news, and then I think that there are these continuities, historical continuities with American political culture when it comes to the use of, when it comes to responses to security issues. So there is a tendency historically to find military, quote unquote, solutions to these problems. So this isn't necessarily a new thing, and I'm not sure that drones are changing anything. If anything, they're just reinforcing an existing culture which, since World War II, has really favored military options over other options.
Clinton was 20 years ago. Clinton bombed the Serbs to the peace table. Where's the peace table? I mean, it's not a continuum. You know, we seem to have forgotten something in the last 20 years.
In terms of the diplomacy, you mean?
Yeah.
Well, this is because of the different sort of, there are a lot of pressures going on in terms of other sort of domestic factors. And, you know, for example, Obama is considered a very weak foreign policy president.
You're saying that the cessation of hostilities is traditionally you're fighting a war in order to bring people to the negotiating table, in order to bring about some kind of
an extension of diplomacy. But an extension of war.
But now there is no armistice because it's just an ongoing.
But that was disastrous. I mean, look. When you look at the historical data over pretty much any period that you want to look at, decades, centuries, even longer than centuries, what you see is a very, very steady decline in violence. You see less wars being fought, and the wars that are being fought have lower levels of casualty than they had in the past. It's very, very striking. That's right. So this is a Steven Pinker, although, I mean, he essentially aggregates a whole series of other very, very robust data. It's not really his data. It's very, very striking. So when you say that we're kind of living in an age that privileges the military over the diplomatic, I'm not sure that the data really bears that out. It may well be that the leaders that we have are not particularly diplomatically skilled, but you know, the old day of wars for peace, where the, you know, gave us the eras of industrialized mass slaughter.
Perhaps Clinton was the aberration, but when the Americans were about to go into Iraq and Syria, they phoned the State Department and said, how many of Secretary of State Kerry's meetings over the last 3 months have been with the UN? And they said, none. I know the UN is a special force as far as the United States is concerned, but to me that's a really fundamental underlying problem that we have.
But isn't it the lack of the imagery, the lack of the media coverage, the lack of, for want of a better word, popular accountability, which leads to some quite lazy decision making at a governmental level? We don't have a lack of imagery.
We have an inundation of imagery.
What?
I mean, the imagery is available.
It's not making it
selected.
It's entirely selected. Yeah, it's not. We don't have the pressure of what's happening on our TV screens. Really, people calling to account the use of weaponry in these new battlefields. It's not happening. It's just not being part of the current discourse. Therefore, it's easy to kind of continue policies of killing people without any accountability, because if there's no even media accountability, there will be no legal accountability. It's just not happening. It doesn't make it to the screen. One question I want to ask you is, and this is kind of goes back to the relevance of, kind of new technologies of war, is the idea of virtue and virtuelessness. And this kind of comes out of One thing that British Air Chief Marshall wrote about this idea that drones would lead to virtueless warfare where the soldier had no emotional connectivity to the battle space. But it also chimed with people I spoke to one of the times I was in Pakistan, talking to villagers from Waziristan, talking about their relatives who had been killed. And they basically talked about exactly the same concept, that what outraged them was, on the one hand, that their brother wasn't a terrorist, they said, but that he had died a virtueless death, that he had... It was a cowardly way to die and a cowardly way to kill, and that they had no chance to seek revenge or retribution. And it was that was what really outraged them, was this lack of virtue in the way in which their relatives had died. So I just wonder, is that something which is kind of new in terms of drone warfare, this idea of virtuelessness in death and fighting?
I've been reading Philip Ball's new book on invisibilities. I don't know if you've had a chance to look at it. And he opens with a discussion of the historical engagement, encounter with the myth of the invisible. So the invisible cloak, the invisible helmet that renders a subject quite powerful through this introduction of this magical power. And specifically, I think he responds to that sort of question by saying that there is something very culturally that produces anxiety by when we cannot see someone else. And so there's something that we've been taught about, that there is something of a thief in the night about making yourself invisible, because by giving yourself the power to be invisible and not to be able to, say, return a gaze, allows you to have a power that you can go and do things like steal money or have relations, right? Exactly. And so there's something that we find very uncomfortable about the idea that we cannot see our enemy.
But to return to the historical point, I mean, this idea of the virtueless weapon is very, very old. I mean, you know, famously the crossbow was deemed to be a virtueless weapon because it enabled a commoner to bring down a nobleman. I mean, I think that this kind of nostalgia for the virtues of the kind of, you know, the combatant who faces his enemy across the field and risks, I think it's utter nonsense. I think, you know, whatever military virtues we have and whatever, you know, good and restraining roles we hope that they will play in war are far outweighed by the vices and the lusts and the, you know, the criminal impulses that are much, much more prevalent. And that plays into the question that you raised before, when it moves to something that's fully autonomous, where there is no human agency at all. And a lot of people have this mentality, you know, where will the military virtue be then? My view is we won't miss it.
That idea of virtue immediately took me back to with J. de Coromance, and that was about the use of gas, the technology of gas. Again, the kind of, and that goes right back to Horace, and that's where that phrase comes from, his own, which is encouraging the youth of Rome to carry out their martial training and go fight the Parthians, and that you will achieve immortality through doing that. I agree, it's bogus. But the one thing which is different is, you know, Wilfred Owen's poem was about a gas attack, and it was about how shocking the physicality, the horror, the real visceral disgust of death through gas was on this massive killing field.
We have to be very careful not to assume that the drone operators, the analysts, aren't feeling that. They're just not sharing it. I spent a lot for the book, and this whole creation of this idea of PlayStation mentality, button killing, absolute labels. You talk to operators, and they have the absolute opposite problem, which is over empathy for the subjects that they then kill. They know
because they can see their faces.
They know the intimate details of many of the people's lives that they're killing. And I was told of an extraordinary story about a young lieutenant. It was her first job, it was her first day on the drone squad. And she observed a mission that it was not a kinetic mission. It was just they were observing, and it was in Iraq. It was a suspect car. The car got to a village. They bundled a tribal leader out of the booth. They executed him, chopped his head off, and they buried him in a hole. This poor lieutenant. This was her first action. That's what she saw, and she was powerless. She had no ability to explain that. They had to get the priest in the middle of the night. She never flew again on the Dran, so this big crisis. And time and again, when you talk to the operators, they have the empathy. They have all the empathy you want with the villagers. It's just the villagers have nothing with them. And so it's a one-way thing. And I was very touched by the humanity of the drone operators and how much they hated to kill and how rarely they killed, by the way. The act of killing was very rare for drone operators.
Yeah. There is something really interesting about this. So I have a friend who runs a group in New York called Witness that do a lot of work essentially on technologies that enable remote observation and remote participation. Particularly in conflict zones and political struggles, or in cases where mass human rights atrocities are occurring. And, I mean, you know, we've been talking about drones and what's new about them in terms of their ability to kill at a distance, but just as important, perhaps, is our ability to let us see at a different distance, and that is really observe and witness and feel as though we're participating in a crime or an atrocity that's happening on the other side of the globe in a way that we would never be able to do that. And what's very interesting to me is how that changes, as it were, the morality of presence and the morality of participation. Because, for most of human history, morality was essentially local. Right? You felt a sense of engagement and obligation towards those who were around you, and that was a very, very small number of people. Television already gave us an ability to see things at a distance, but with new kinds of observations through camera phones, through live streaming, and drones are a particularly pervasive and intimate aspect of that, you can really have the opportunity to participate, to observe, to witness an action in real time. And what does that mean in terms of the obligations that we may recognize to respond, to support, to help, to assist? What does it mean if we are unable or unwilling to do that? What kinds of systems, political, technological, might we have to think about putting in place in order to respond appropriately to that? I think those are really profound questions that this technology raises as well.
I mean, the whole question of PTSD amongst drone operators, drone operators famously get teased by other members of the Air Force for being, armchair pilots But the data is, and certainly if you read interviews with former drone pilots, like the PTSD that they experience is just as profound, if not even more so. But it stems from what I think has been a kind of the consensus is that there's been a shift in the understanding of what PTSD is from the old-fashioned First World War idea that it stems from constant fear of mortal danger, having shells landing on you day in, day out, to this idea of a moral wound. And there's no reason why a drone pilot sitting in a cockpit in Nevada would not suffer a moral wound from watching the kind of thing that you just described, the rookie pilot did, to somebody in a battle zone firing a gun. Would you say that that's...
Yeah, because it gives you that sense of proximity, of intimacy, that elicits all of those natural physical and human and moral emotions, but often without... Assuming they're not a sociopath, yeah, but very few of us, very few of us are not. It's very hard to watch something like that and not be moved. Mm. But how do you respond, right? I mean, if you're watching a live video feed of somebody about to be raped or executed on the other side of the world, how can you respond? How ought you respond? We don't have a good place for it for that.
On that PTSD question, by the way, PTSD is a terrible measure for the stresses for drone pilots and operators. I spoke with Air Force psychologists, US Air Force psychologists, who said the rate of PTSD among operators is actually lower than the general population. It's around 4% versus around 5-6% of the US population. Combat veterans coming back from Afghanistan and Iraq, it was as high as 20%. But that didn't mean there wasn't a problem, it's just that PTSD is a model for the battlefield or for physiological stress caused usually by proximity to events. They are toying with a whole new definition to reflect virtual combat stress and the complex mesh of stressors that is creating a different kind of battlefield stress. So they're actually toying with a new term for it because PTSD doesn't fit the model anymore. Mm.
I mean, I've read, correct me if I'm wrong, but I've read data that I think about 3 or 4 years ago that the veteran suicide rate had exceeded the combat mortality rate in certain divisions. Is that true? So there were more American soldiers coming home committing suicide than dying on the battlefield.
That was last year, wasn't it?
That's been the case for Afghanistan for the last few years. That's simply because the numbers dying on the battlefield fell rather than the suicides rose. There were not quite enough dying on the battlefield to cancel out the suicides, as it were. So, but a lot of suicides. I mean, 2.5 million. American men and women have been through Iraq and Afghanistan. It's a staggering number of people have been on the battlefield.
And the fatality rates are incredibly low because battlefield medicine is so... I mean, almost nobody dies in battlefield medicine because the battlefield medicine is so good. Right, I mean, they get traumatic injuries, but they don't typically die. That's another big...
I think one thing, this whole discussion has been about the American use of drones. Yeah. And kind of what are the implications of this technology for what other countries are going to do with it? Mm-hmm. Is it going to lead to extraordinary proliferation of weaponry? Is that going to happen? And the other thing is, you know, they're basically being used against one target, and that is Muslims. That's what we're talking about. That, you know, drone warfare is war against civilian Muslims, which is pretty appalling. That's kind of one context to this warfare and this use of technology, which perhaps is new and is different.
I think if there was a weapon on the battlefield that only killed Christians or only killed Jews, we would be horrified.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, you have to look very, very, very hard to find a tiny number of cases of non-Muslims killed. Now, that's simply the context of the war we are in, but that's the reality. And if you're looking at this from another perspective, a weapon that has only killed Muslims is quite a shocking thing.
Well, I was talking to an Air Force lawyer a little while back who said, he said the very first time that a foreign drone kills a US serviceman on US soil, the question of the legality of the use of drones in America will be instantly set in there.
No, I think, yes, absolutely. I mean, I don't want to go, well, I will go to the atomic comparison, but, you know, it wasn't until the Soviets exploded their own bomb that there was a bit more incentive to establish some kind of regulation system, which ultimately failed.
But also, we've been talking a lot about the ethics of targeting a particular individual using drone technology versus conventional. But what about the effect on the rest of the community who's not being targeted, but who's simply living under the constant? So, I mean, this phrase up here, "the sky is above a blue," I mean, it's a line from the Etta James song that's in one of those videos, but it's also, for me, it's a reference to some of the interviews that you read with kids and teenagers living in Waziristan, who actually talk about the fact that they're now afraid to go out on sunny days with blue skies because the drones don't operate during cloud cover. So now, for the first time in human history, I think, this universal symbol of innocence and you know, a beautiful...
I would dispute that, because it was exactly the same during the Battle of Britain and the Blitz. Mm. When it was a clear day, when it was a clear day, the bombers came. When it was cloudy, they didn't.
Fair enough.
They might be more happy as well.
They might what?
Be more happy because they survived.
Who would be more happy?
The children who didn't lose their life, because if it was a massive bomb, instead of, you know, they would feel grateful for being still alive. Even if they have the experience of death, they will appreciate the life more. It's more philosophical, sorry for that.
I mean, I've never experienced it, but I remember very vividly a conversation with a Red Cross worker who had just returned from a stint of 6 months in a town on the Afghanistan-Pakistan border, and she said that experience of living under drones for that period was one of the most shocking experiences of her entire life. She said, you constantly were aware of it. You know, they're called drones because of the noise it makes. You hear this droning sound all the time. You can't see them, but you know they're up there. You know they're observing you all the time. And you know that at any moment, fire and death can just literally come out of the sky. And she said that feeling, and she said it's impossible to communicate how incredibly terrifying that experience was. She said she would have preferred to have regular roadside bombs to living under that any day of the week. I thought that was very, very striking.
So, Chris, in terms of the PTSD model being a model that's geared up towards, you know, post-battlefield trauma, what are we talking about for civilians?
Certainly the studies, the numerous studies now in the tribal areas. The tribal areas are tiny. Fatah is the size of the Bahamas. And, 500 drone strikes in there, hundreds of drone operations weekly. This is a very small area with a relatively small population under pretty much constant surveillance. Might remind us of Gaza a little bit as well. And it's similar in a way. The number of studies now showing, high dependence on antidepressants, high dependence on beta blockers, high levels of stress among pregnant mums, high levels of miscarriages, there are. But, and this is where I think we have to be really careful with the but, we have to understand that is within the context of the airstrikes by the Pakistan Army, suicide bombs by the Taliban, ongoing operations from across the border, possibly shelling from the Afghan army. This is an environment where it's not possible for us to demark and break this down and lay this all at the door of the drones. I think we can say it's a significant part of it, but it's actually about a predominantly civilian population living under a constant threat of violence, full stop. And that is the bigger problem.
I would also just want to kind of what I said about the kind of the lack of media discourse from our point of view about this weaponry, from the other side, from the other's view, from what's happening from what's seen on television, what's reported, as I understand, in the Middle East, in Muslim countries, is the radicalisation of this weaponry is phenomenal. Well, as with Guantanamo Bay, they become a symbol. They are just a symbol of radicalisation, full radicalisation of the injustice of the war being carried out by the West on us. And it is us. And the kind of, we don't really understand the effect that is having in these countries. We don't get it. America does not understand the impact of Guantanamo with drones in the Middle East, in Muslim countries. We just don't understand it.
I think we should throw it up. Does anybody have any questions?
I have two remarks. What are we thinking, only Jews or Christians? There are experiments now for border robots on the borders between Mexico and the USA to stop immigrants from crossing and then basing it on biometrics of someone who looks like a Mexican. And I think that would be the first time that there will be a weapon that is fully autonomous. The decision will be made by an algorithm to stop someone, to zap someone, to stop him from moving.
Biometrically.
They have them in the DMZ in Korea already. Samsung made them.
Yes. But there is no verified info coming from North Korea.
What do they mean?
For the lack of transparency.
Well, essentially, killing robots is big, giant gun turret robots that can sense a figure, aim and fire.
In the demilitarized zone.
Exactly. Well, that makes it a bit easier.
Anything that moves, kill it.
Yeah.
And actually, the same company that is developing these robots for the use on the borders are the ones that are creating drones. So I think that the system that will be applied on the drones for the future, when it becomes fully autonomous, will be based on the same algorithms. And the second point is, I think that we should be more afraid about drones that are being used for surveillance, for recording the everyday life of everybody, basically.
Sam, my comment when you were just talking about how the legality of drones would become an issue when an American was killed on American soil. And I just wonder if we will have to wait that long in some ways, because it seems to me there will be some convergence to do with surveillance drones and the right to privacy. And just an example that keeps coming to my mind was my my brother was in New York staying in a flat with a skylight and was running around half naked, and suddenly there's a drone hovering over that skylight.
You mean the little remote control ones?
Yeah. With a camera. Pointing at him. And it's just sitting there.
He's in South Park.
And that's that sort of moment of feeling this is utterly wrong. And I just wonder where what might happen just with those simple little toys that kids have now.
Well, the BBC, I don't know if you saw it, Davos, the BBC has been fined for sending two drones up to get overhead coverage. Which they've used, you know, obviously in Ferguson, and there have been a lot of cases where that the anniversary of the liberation of Auschwitz, they used it to a plane, but then they used these little camera drones over Davos, and suddenly the Swiss authorities came down with a ton of bricks and a fine.
And find them on what basis? What was the legal ground for that?
Because it was a no-fly zone.
Oh.
Yeah, they breached it.
I just remembered something about technology and accuracy, and Elspeth, you can help me with this. Do you remember a Canadian academic who was... he was talking about this interesting thing about the kind of the legality, the disputed legality in places like Waziristan about drones, is that they're not accurate and they kill hundreds of people. And then the disputed legality in Palestine, the use of Israeli use of drones, was that they are accurate, so the Israelis know exactly who they're killing. Was these two very different
isn't it the other way around?
Legal?
Isn't it the other way around? To me, the accuracy is all about intent. If you don't particularly care about civilians, you'll kill a lot of civilians. If you don't want to kill a lot of civilians, you probably won't. And that's where drones sort of.
But it was that lawyers were saying to the Israelis, these are incredibly accurate. You know exactly who you're killing. Therefore, you're responsible. Whereas in Waziristan, where we've been told these are accurate, we're only killing individuals, lawyers were saying, these are not accurate, you're killing lots of people, you're responsible for lots of civilian deaths. So then it's kind of completely contradictory.
I mean, when you talk about questions like accuracy and precision, the question you have to ask is accurate in comparison to what? Right? What would the alternative be? If the alternative would be, you know, sending in special, you know, highly trained special forces to do, you know, an insertion, then that's very different than if the alternative is, you know, conducting a carpet bombing, you know, or doing or look at the program as a whole. I mean, the program is horrific and it kills many thousands of people, but if the alternative was conducting an Iraq-scale invasion that killed somewhere in the region of 600,000 people, then so the alternatives really matter.
A fair alternative, really? I mean, just to be a bit argumentative, because could one not say not do anything at all?
Absolutely, that's absolutely right.
But isn't that also the issue, is that full-scale invasions are few and far between, precisely because they carry political cost.
Yeah.
But when there's no political cost with the use of drones, those military interventions are going to become, even if they're more precise, they're going to become, you know,
that's certainly entirely possible, but then you'd have to ask what's the long-term consequence of that. So you know the famous parable about forest fires in the American national parks. So through the 1960s and 1970s, the Park Service has got very, very good at fighting forest fires. So they're able to put them out very effectively by using planes to drop water on them. And it was great. For 10 or 15 years, they had no forest fires at all in the parks. And then, of course, what happened is that dry wood built up and built up and built up. And then all of a sudden, there was a catastrophic fire that they couldn't put out. And it wiped out vast areas of forestry. Now, the parallel here, I'll obviously say, things like drones, they enable you to use force much more easily than war. And you might think, well, that's a bad thing because it means that people will resort to force more often. But you might say, well, but that's a little bit like allowing small forest fires regularly, and it precludes a giant catastrophic forest fire. The threshold is very, very high. The worry is that you won't have outbreaks for a long period, but when it does come, it will be catastrophic.
Sure.
Now,
what point is this a preemptive strike, though?
Sorry.
At one point is at what point are you have to be absolutely certain that there would be a giant fire?
But if you look at Al Qaeda in Pakistan after 9/11, there were no drain strikes in Pakistan until 2004. Al-Qaeda was mostly rolled up by a good old-fashioned kicking doors down, arresting people, and sending them to Guantanamo. Mm. There was a law and order option. There was one in Yemen as well. In fact, I write about this in the book, the FBI was heavily involved in rolling up with the security apparatus in Yemen, those responsible for the USS Cole. The CIA never told them they were going to carry out that first drone strike, that assassination in 2002. They already had a law and order apparatus there, and this is my real concern about this. It's fire or fire. We seem to just drop the law and order aspect.
Well, that's it. The technology is great. We're going to kill less people. If we fight wars, we're going to do it with robots. There are going to be a lot of less deaths. That's kind of hard. You know, what's not to like?
Now, this is
but it's the legality. It's the fact that that means now we can do it all the time, all the time. We can change, shift the goalposts all the time about what is and what isn't a war, and what's a battlefield, what isn't a battlefield. That's the problem.
Well, the objection
is
the legal framework that you're objecting to.
Yeah. The legal and moral framework, because we are talking about a huge moral shift since the war on terror. But the morality of combat has completely shifted.
But this is also going back to your point. You know, Obama famously says in his speech, you know, we only conduct drone strikes when an individual poses an imminent threat, however you define that, and the possibility of capture is not available. And we know that's not true, and particularly on the CIA's drone program, that just doesn't happen. So, and, you know, there have even been commentators who talked about the fact that, yes, Obama's willing to close Guantanamo as soon as he can kind of get enough of a kind of political will, because now he just kills people. The United States no longer captures and imprisons indefinitely on an island that is outside of US jurisdiction. It just kills people. And so that has been the go-to.
I think it's more fundamental than that. It is the United States under Obama. Bush with his drone strikes. Bush, I mean, they were assassinations, but drone strikes under Bush, and they were classified, they were kind of socially awkward about the whole thing, and nobody really talked. What happens when Obama comes in and he sweeps away all that awful apparatus that came out of the kind of corrupting of international rule of law under Bush, the torture, the rendition? He kept the drones, but the drones came out of that same mess, actually, the targeted killings beyond the hot battlefield. And instead of throwing it out, as he did with torture and rendition, Obama's turned it into a formal public plank of US foreign policy. We now have diplomacy, we have assassination, and we have coercion. And he's made speeches where he talks about targeted killing being a plank of US foreign policy. And that I find really problematic, that's such a fundamental shift away from the post-war, it's not even the post-war settlement, it's the 20th century settlement around IHL, that has kind of kept the whole rickety thing vaguely together. And I think this is why countries like China and Russia are so uncomfortable with the US drone program. It's not the technology. It's not even how they use it on the battlefield. It's the assassinations. It's the public assassinations. It's all states assassinate, as far as I can tell. But what the United States now do...
They're making a public virtue of it.
Yeah, and it's a part of their policy. And
yes.
He's making jokes about the...
Obama has killed 5 times more people with drones than have died as a result of due process through executions in the United States during his time in office. I mean, that's a lot of deaths without any kind of legal process.
But isn't Israel the other state that has had a long program of assassinations?
Yeah.
And also the other state that uses drones consistently?
I spoke to a senior IDF official who helped to sort of draw up the legal framework for the Israeli drone assassination program. It had a broader assassination program. It was absolutely fascinating because the Israelis sort of had an ad hoc assassination program. We all know that. You know, they would bump off Nazis or people involved in atrocities and so on. In the second intifada, that changed and it shifted to a more formal assassination program. And he told me that it was only when they did the second assassination that one of the generals turned around to him and said, "Is this actually legal?" And it was that far down the process that they then actually addressed themselves to the lawfulness or not. And in fact, Israel prides itself because, in terms of lawfulness, they pushed it all the way to the Supreme Court. And the Israeli Supreme Court gave a very interesting ruling which said that it's neither lawful nor unlawful. Each individual assassination or possible assassination must be judged on its own merits as regards to international law and domestic law, which is not a bad position, you might say. Whereas actually what the US has done is everything it can to keep the program away from the courts. The US courts still cannot rule on the legality of this program. Of course, they keep the international courts away as well. So the Israelis are quite an interesting, they see themselves as having quite a solid legal position at the moment in terms of assassination because of that Supreme Court ruling.
Thank you.
Any other questions?
Can we just go back right to the beginning, talking about the newness of the technology, the newness of the idea of it?
Yeah.
It seems to me that it goes back to the beginnings of flight, the combination of flight and the kind of technologies of photography, film photography, being able to survey, but also having a vehicle that can carry a weapon.
Yeah.
So I'm not sure, for me, I'm not sure it is anything new in a sense. I mean, these things, ever since the invention. Flight and photography, which come very close together.
Yeah.
They've been in this very intimate relationship. That's one of the things that changed the entire, in the 20th century. Mm-hmm. Changes is modern warfare.
We had unmanned bombs in the Second World War.
The idea of civilians becoming a target, a legitimate target in warfare, that all comes out of the experience with British Air Force.
Never underestimate the way that technological transformations can become very profound, not necessarily because there's anything technically new, but just because of effects of scale and cost and price. So it may well be that the drones are really a game changer just because they become so cheap and so pervasive that they literally are everywhere. And I think when you think about drones, you need to think about not only as they are now and as they're used now, but as Chris was saying, as markers and a potential almost inevitable transition to something different. I mean, what they essentially are is these are the beginnings of military robots, and they will become more able to act on their own, to act autonomously. They will act in different environments, not only in the air, but on the ground, and on the sea, and under the sea. And so I think those combination of those two things, the scale and the cost of them, and their transition towards increasingly more autonomous robotic forms, I think is something really, potentially really quite transformative.
I want to pick you up on something though, because you're talking about the forest fire analogy, and that maybe there's a sort of a pressure valve back to going on. You go back to our earlier conversation, David has proposed one of the things that we have in place at the moment in international law are the rules governing my Latin is so bad, Justin Poem.
Yeah.
The rules governing war.
Yeah,
and we have rules governing how we can enter war, but what we don't have are rules governing the process by which we leave a state of war. And one of the things that, correct me if I'm wrong, that David has advocated for is some kind of a process by which we can leave a state of war. And what do we think of when we think of what is, how do you define a state of war? Well, it's when anything goes, when it's people, brings out the worst in people. Essentially, it's a breakdown in the social contract. The rules, the law ceases to exist and pretty much anything goes. But then you have this other set of rules which govern conduct during law. So on the one hand, you're kind of making an argument for this pressure valve, forest fire kind of system, whereby we kind of let steam off gently. And on the other hand, you're advocating for new statutes and new kind of terminology, new ways of conceptualizing a transition back into normal civilian life. Aren't the two kind of a little bit at odds with each other?
So first of all, let me just say, with the forest fire analogy, I wasn't meaning to advocate or justify anything. It was simply a point about when you make claims like a new technology will have an effect on the recourse to war because it'll make it more easy, all I was saying was hold on, step back and say, do we really know that?
Yes.
Because it may well be, if you look at the forest fire analogy, that yes, we will have more frequent but smaller conflicts, but that may help to forestall a giant catastrophic conflict. My view on that is, and this is the reason that I'm not a consequentialist, for those who know about philosophical ethics, consequentialists are people who say the right thing to do is the thing that generates best overall consequences for all involved. One of the reasons I'm not a consequentialist is it's just darn near impossible to figure out what actually will generate best overall consequences. There's a famous article by Ed Lubbock, a famous political theorist, who says, look, if you really want to minimize harm and suffering in war, don't have any rules of war at all. You know, it was Tolstoy, actually, who first articulated that. Yeah, give war a chance. He says, look, let people do whatever they want to each other. It'll be so horrific and so grim. No one will ever go to war. Now, you know, is that true? I don't know. It sounds kind of plausible, but there are a lot of other arguments that are plausible as well. So
that's
in
Syria, really.
No, that's right. But it's just to say that whenever you make these kind of long-term causal arguments about what changes in policy or technology will have on the incidence of warfare or recourse to war, just be aware that it's a very dangerous, tricky...
I just want to say something about just in bello, just ad bello, because that kind of, I remember writing, that kind of came out of Thomas Aquinas, his kind of crystallisation of classical philosophy in relation to capitalism. And the kind of the key thing about Aquinas was it was the idea of natural law, that the ruler was not above the law.
Right.
The ruler had to obey the same laws that the rest of us who lived under him in those days had to obey. So what we're saying, the reality of the situation seems to be a relatively difficult word, but is that America doesn't do that, because it makes up its own bloody laws all the time. The drones are... Perhaps
no,
the way that that is not actually then happening.
But the modern inheritor of that very, very old idea of natural law is the modern notion of human rights law. And this, what's incredibly powerful about the whole language, both legal but also the kind of broader ethical language of human rights, is that it gives us a way to articulate those claims and to confront the powerful who do... sees for themselves.
Yeah, but America is not part of the International Court of Human Rights.
No,
it doesn't believe in it.
No,
they are to some extent. They don't, I mean, I think Chris was talking about them sort of saying, they don't go around saying we assassinate people, right? They do still make an effort to...
Powell calls it targeted assassination. I think that's quite honest.
Yes, but Colin Powell's in a unique position now. He's no longer part of the administration.
But he is the leader.
But official, there are no officials who, in still an official capacity, will turn around and say,
that's a sophistry.
It's not a sophistry. It's still a
subscription.
Whereas the torture, Dick Cheney did sort of come out and say, we will torture
really
people.
So
I think that there's...
Simply because they don't call it what it is not something for us to think is a good thing. I really don't. It is assassination. I mean, it is. It's beyond the confines of the hot battlefield. Even on the hot battlefield, drones assassinate. But, it's so specific. We will kill leader X beyond the hot battlefield.
It's
in a country where we are not.
If they get to it, if they justify that as a legal target, it's not an assassination, is it? Because it is a battle space. It's a battlefield. Therefore, it's not an assassination.
And you're assuming as well that there can never be such a thing as a morally appropriate assassination. And I'm not sure
that
that is actually...
You
can imagine cases. I mean, you can imagine, for example, an operation to assassinate a political leader or head of state who was currently pursuing an act of genocide where there was no alternative.
Yeah.
Then
right at the beginning, saying there are very few targeted killings outside the hot battlefield, which fitted imminence. But I would say that there have been some, but I would say the majority of them probably.
But I mean, to come back to the point about human rights, it's true that America has a very ambiguous position in terms of their legal participation in those frameworks. But what's absolutely beyond question is that the language, the mechanism, the idea of human rights has a profound effect on American policy and politics. And not only America, but I mean, there's a lot of research that shows the effects that it has even on very illiberal governments. Simply by framing a debate in a way that constrains the options for legitimate forms of action. So, you know, it's not a panacea, it's not a cure-all, but it's been an incredibly powerful feature of the post-Second World War.
I think what's quite... Sorry.
No, well, it's quite a very facile point, that the court of public opinion, popular culture, where we have example after example, from Dirty Harry to today, of the vigilante killing, the justification of torture, because it does give us that information. Mm-hmm. Zero Dark 30, Guantanamo revealed information which led to the killing of Bin Laden. That's bollocks. It's not true. But that's the justification of torture, the justification of extrajudicial killing, is fundamentally important and powerful in popular culture.
Obama,
if that's the case, and there's no media account, they can get away with what they want. There is
Obama
no
gave a speech a while ago where he joked about American exceptionalism. He said, America is exceptional. And it wasn't really very funny. When the EU CIA General Counsel gave had her hearing before Congress last year, she was asked what happens when IHL clashes with domestic law as regards to the CIA. And she gave an unbelievably honest answer. And she basically said, the CIA, I'm paraphrasing obviously, the CIA, we follow domestic law, we'll follow customary international law as so far as it agrees with domestic law, but that's the limit. And in terms of CIA operations, and the reality is, so long as their backside is covered domestically, they feel themselves to be pretty much free to do what they will.
The Constitution and the Supreme Court of the United States, that's where the buck stops in terms of US law. It's never been international. But I think it's kind of interesting and ironic that, obviously been interested in this issue of the CIA's refusal to acknowledge its covert drone program and the use of the GLOMAR response, which is this phrasing, can neither confirm nor deny the existence or non-existence when a Freedom of Information Act request is submitted. And this kind of untenable position that it maintains in terms of not acknowledging anything, and yet at the same time coming under enormous criticism for leaking through media channels, most famously like the New York Times, that famous New York Times interview, in which anonymous White House advisors talked about the fact that they were basically leaking things that they thought would show the Obama administration in a positive light. And one of those things was the fact that every decision about a drone strike went straight to the top, to Obama's desk, and that he himself had been schooled in the just war theories of Thomas Aquinas and St. Augustine. So on the one hand, you have a refusal to be a signatory of the ICCL. On the other hand, they're kind of, when they want to try and paint themselves in a positive light, they're using precisely those kind of moral frameworks to explain to the American people why what they're doing is actually quite justifiable.
And also remember that the United States has been an absolutely key and fundamental driver to the establishment of this framework of international law. I mean, essentially, all of the major features that we know as contemporary international law, including the ICC, were fundamentally creatures of American policy and jurisprudence. At the end, they often pull back and don't want to participate.
But that's what is so tragic. I grew up believing that it was the land of the free and the just. I've spoken to men held in Guantanamo Bay saying, I grew up watching telly, I thought Americans were great. When they handed me over to the Americans, I thought, thank God, I can save hands. And then look what they did to me.
There were no African Americans on your television screen.
No.
The shattering
of that illusion, that's fundamental.
There was actually, the Guantanamo diary that's just been published, and there's a note by Mahamudu, which has finally been declassified and finally been published. There's this one description where he talks about being placed in nappies on the rendition flight from, I think it's either from Jordan to Bagram or from Bagram back when they hand him over and send him to Guantanamo. And it's at that moment when he's been put in nappies, because he's hooded, that he realises that he's in the hands of the Americans and that he's going to be okay.
Wow.
Well, we tend to think of Obama as sort of post-Bush. We're still in the post-9/11 kind of mess.
Yeah.
I mean, and Obama is, in terms of foreign policy, fighting far more wars than Bush did, in far more aggressively, you know, far more troops committed, far more assassinations, for example. A lot of that is responding, you know, you couldn't predict the Arab Spring, although, of course, you know, the complication of how much things like Iraq and contributed to the Arab Spring, but this is a continuation of this huge shift in American positions after 9/11, and I think we're just a third or even a quarter of the way through it.
Oh,
it feels like this is an era now that we're kind of locked into. And I think, you know, things like IHL will start, if we're not careful, will start seeing like a very fond memory.
Yeah,
if we're not
absolutely
careful.
Absolutely. I couldn't agree more. Yeah.
But I mean, look, I mean, here we are in Britain, and we've been talking for about an hour and a half about America. Neither of them are American. I mean, so the question is, you know, where are the European states? Where is Europe? Where is our own government on these really big, decisive... Where are we taking the stand?
Complicit.
Well, you talked about Israel being the only. It's Israel being the only other country that's participating actively in the drain. Britain, of course, is the omission there. But Britain has refused. What's that? But all of Britain's flights, Chris will be able to tell.
Our own drones only operate on the regular battlefield, so that's the difference between
Royal Air Force in Afghanistan.
Yeah. So
everything is
within designated wars and so on. But actually, very interesting. When the British knew they were going to come out of Afghanistan, they had a whole discussion because. Discussions with very senior RAF people about this, and they were saying, "Well, we want to stay in with the Americans. We want to be part of this." And they kind of knew they had to follow the action. So the British were talking about basically stationing their drones in Djibouti, and then it was all going to get a bit grey because that's where the counter-terrorism stuff is for Yemen and Somalia, and this is the assassinations that we kept away from, certainly with our military, not our intelligence services. So. Iraq saved the RAF because it gave us a war we could send our drones to, and there were happy people at the RAF that they suddenly had somewhere to send the drones to. There was a legitimate war. So they are a weapon in search of a war for the British sometimes, which is...
think. Yes?
So I'm feeling a bit depressed now. Yeah. Can I have a response from the speakers about how we can stop drones? Do you think we can stop them, or do you think they have to just be monitored? Is there something in the fact that this whole labelling of immediate threat, maybe that needs to be tightened up? What do you think our best hope is in terms of policing drones?
Christoph Haynes is one of the UN rapporteurs, the rapporteur on extrajudicial killings. So Christoph has numerous reports on this, and he's got a very simple phrase. The drones follow the law doesn't follow the drones. And it's really that simple. We have all the laws there that we need to regulate their behaviour. We just can't get into the situation where we think that the law has to play catch up with what these new weapon systems are doing on the battlefield. That's where my head is.
I rather suspect, as someone said earlier, is that we will have to wait until a major player, aside from the US, starts operating a little bit more globally in order to get the US to agree to some kind of talks about ways to restrict their operations. Because, I mean, they have a globe to play with at the moment.
You had an interesting point about last a couple of weeks ago on the fact, because I was asking, why is it that China and Russia and Turkey and a number of other countries, all of whom are capable of flying drones and mounting munitions on them, don't? Why don't they weaponize their drones? Why don't they carry out strikes? And Chris said they're pretty much sitting back, rope-a-doping it, because they get more political... There's more political mileage to be had out of criticizing the Americans than actually conducting their own... You know, why isn't the Chinese government conducting drone strikes in Tibet? Why isn't the Russian government conducting drone strikes in Chechnya? They get more... You were saying they get more out of...
I think it's that they can certainly make hay with the Americans at the moment and make a lot of trouble for them, and they do within the UN, for example. But I also think there's a genuine issue here for the Chinese and for the Russians who assassinate you know, we've got a trial going on in this country at the moment, or an inquiry going on about the murder by the KGB of an individual on the streets of London. That's a straightforward assassination by a state. But I don't think Russia and China want this to come out of the shadows. They don't want it to be part of foreign policy, regular foreign policy, and I don't think any of us do, actually. I think the idea of 200 states all practicing assassination as part of regular statecraft is terrifying, frankly terrifying. So I think there's, while they're making hay with the Americans, I think there's something much more fundamental for the Chinese and the Russians right now, which is we don't want to go there. I mean, they'll keep doing their nasty killings, but they just want it. They want it behind the shadow. They don't want to right hand there up front, because I think there's that wonderful film, The Gatekeepers, which is about the Israeli Shin Bet service. And one of the former heads of Shin Bet says, you know, we started our targeted assassinations, and it was fine, and then it just became a conveyor belt, and we didn't know how to turn it off. And it's and to me, that's a fascinating. You know, that it reaches such a scale that you don't know, you don't have to stop that.
Are there cases of individuals using drones?
Say that again?
Cases of individuals using drones?
As what? Or just using drones? I mean, there are lots of
the little drones?
No, more kind of as a weapon, yeah, kind of a form of attack, you know, one individual getting, make.
It's surprising that organized crime haven't used them, to my knowledge.
Well, they do use them to transport drugs.
To transport, yes, but not for something surprising there. Mm-hmm. I mean, just to come back to the question before, I mean, I think my view on that is slightly different in the sense that I think it's, I don't think we'll ever be able to stop drones in the sense of turning back the clock on the technology. They're here and they're not going to go away. What I would like to see is the use of them insofar as there are genuine necessary cases for using them, brought much more closely into line with the law and the norms of domestic policing. Right? So we say to the police that they are empowered to use sometimes lethal force if that is the only way to stop a criminal actor from committing a very, very grave unjust harm. But it has to be right in that moment of imminent threat, and the use has to be proportionate. And I think that when you think about the permissible use of drones more broadly, that's essentially what we're talking about. So I think what we need to have is domestic and international legal structures that can give that kind of oversight to that use, to make sure that they are used only in those circumstances and that there is some kind of appropriate and robust review process that occurs afterwards. So, I mean, in my view, you know, the right way of thinking about the legality of drones is not actually laws of war at all. It's something much closer to the law of domestic criminal policing.
Precisely because it's ongoing, it's normalised, it becomes a standard of...
Yeah, it has to be open and it has to be, I mean, it has to be sensitive to the...
No, what I mean is this kind of warfare is not, it's no longer an exceptional thing.
I don't think we should think of it as warfare. I think it's incredibly unhelpful to think about this as warfare. But from the moral perspective, I mean, warfare is essentially, as Clausewitz said, the conduct of politics through force. And my own view is that we as a nation and as a humanity have to reach to a point beyond that. And the point beyond that is where the use of force is fundamentally and solely restricted to cases of imminent prevention of gross, unjust crimes. Those could be small-scale crimes, criminality, they could be large-scale crimes, terrorism, they could be truly atrocious crimes like genocide or massacre. But in either case, what we're talking about is what is the level of force that is appropriate and necessary to stop criminal actions.
Well, to go back to this lady's question, where is the political pressure going to come from? Is it going to come from certain forms of activism? Is it going to come from political process from certain, you know, through legislation? Is it going to be an international, or is it going to be a homegrown domestic?
How
will you bring about that kind of shift you want to see?
I write about it, I talk about it, I think everyone on this panel does as well. There are a huge number of incredible activist groups, human rights groups, advocacy groups. The internet, I think, gives us incredibly powerful tools. I think images like yours are an incredibly powerful way of generating this debate as well. So it comes from all of these sources. But, you know, there's no... History is not a kind of, you know, linear line in the right direction. It's contested, and people who believe in a better and more just and more law-governed order have to fight and struggle for it. And we have as many reverses as we have advances, but there's no alternative to that.
If nobody else has any questions, then it just remains for me to say thank you very, very much to Ed, Elspeth, David and Chris, and thank you all very much for coming. Our next event is a screen of Haroon Faruqi's film War at a Distance. Please come along. Thank you.